Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Center for Anti-Racist Research has released data from its COVID-19 racial tracker, and it sheds new light on racial disparities during the pandemic. According to findings published this week in JAMA, racial disparities in who died from COVID-19 decreased between the initial wave in March 2020 and the Omicron surge. But it wasn't because of better equity in public health. It was because during the Omicron surge, more white Americans died, while mortality rates among communities of color remained relatively flat. Data is at the core of the Center for Anti-Racist Research. Founder Ibram X. Kendi recently sat down with us to talk about that mission and his role in bringing it to fruition. It's the first of a continuing series on the center's work and what it means for us here in Massachusetts. And we'll note that the center is at Boston University, which holds WBUR's license. When Kendi joined me in Studio 2, I started by noting what others call him: author, historian, advocate. But in social media, he notes prominently, hashtag girl dad. So how does he see himself?
You know, as someone who is partnered with the real Dr. Kendi, and we're building, you know, a life together, and part of that life together is our daughter. You know, I think certainly my family and my connection to my family is primary. So, of course, I'm also a son and a brother and a cousin. So I think that's first and foremost, because it's so emblematic of who I am. And then secondarily, I would consider myself to be a scholar, and particularly someone who produces public scholarship, which I think is a little bit different than a public scholar or a public intellectual. I think a public scholar is someone who is simply known by the public, but I'm really trying to produce scholarship that can impact the lives of the public. So I see myself as a scholar. I don't necessarily self-identify as an activist. I self-identify as a scholar.
How do you know if your scholarship has impacted the lives of the public?
So I think there's a number of different ways to know. I think one has been to sort of see my work being used by activists, by educators, by executives, by everyday people, by preachers and people in their organizations and in their communities. I think secondarily is seeing the ways in which it may transform the ways in which people see themselves and their world. And so if someone comes to my work, for instance, thinking that the racial problem are people of color or Black people, and they come out of my work recognizing there's nothing wrong with any racial group of people and everything wrong with racist policies and practices, then to me, that I see that as making a difference.
It strikes me, in the introduction, one of the things I referred to you as was an activist. And then when I asked you how you see yourself, you said, activist, not on my list. But influencing activists is a way you might know that your scholarship has affected the public. Which means there's this chain of influence you may have. Who's in your chain of influence? The people who, you know, past or present, whisper in your ear or sit on your shoulder or guide and inspire you the most, the voices that guide you.
So there's so many. I think everyday people, particularly regular people who are being directly harmed by racism, are an influence on me, whether they're an influence on me because I see the challenges that they're facing, indeed the misery that they're facing as a result of racism that inspires me each day, or even the resistance that they are a part of, which also inspires me and teaches me and moves me. I would also say readers, particularly readers who are providing constructive feedback, which allows me to sort of rethink ways to convey information or to go down a different path of research. And then obviously other scholars and journalists and activists and intellectuals and elected officials and, you know, other people who are similarly doing this work.
Can you tell me, is there somebody you've met, an everyday person you've met here in the city since you've been here, that sticks with you? Their lived experience here in the city is one of those everyday lived experiences you're trying to call forward or serve or change or raise awareness about in the work that you're doing?
There's so many. But one thing I, as an historian, I'm not just, when you ask that question, I'm not just thinking of people who are living, but even people who have lived previously in the city. And one of the people, you know, I just thought about was Mariah Stewart, who was an abolitionist and a feminist. And in the early 1830s, she decided to stand up and speak out against not only slavery, but even racism and sexism in a co-ed interracial audience. And she's known as one of the first, if not the first woman to address a interracial co-ed audience. And Black people and white people, men and women, were angry about her doing so. And, you know, some reports, they sort of chased her out of Boston and she ended up in D.C. And I'm mentioning Stewart because she was not only a trailblazer, but she had the courage and the audacity to say what was right here in Boston and in this nation, and in a way that was right, despite the costs.
Back in 2022, you did an interview here at WBUR for Weekend Edition, right around MLK Day. And you sort of compared the moment we were in then. And boy, January 2022 feels like an eternity ago now. And you compared that time to the early 1960s. I've heard others compare the moment we find ourselves in now to post-Reconstruction, late 1800s into the early 1900s. And I wonder what you think of that comparison to the moment that we're in, given everything that's happened in the country, especially in response to rolling back the teaching of anti-racism, of Black history and slave history in the United States, of the pushback on our racial reckoning, our collective conversation about that since the death of George Floyd in the summer of 2020, and the momentum that we have seen in that pushback in, say, the last 12 months.
I mean, I think it's an apt comparison. And I think that indeed the Reconstruction era, that decade or so after the Civil War, which of course ended in 1865, was a time when there was this collision of values, this collision of power, this collision of interests. And so on the one hand, you had Americans who were extending the right to vote, who were extending civil rights, who were building public schools for all of our children, who sort of utilized government power and resources for the benefit of the majority of people. And then you have the others who are trying to create slavery by another name, others who were opposed to Black men and women receiving the ability to vote. You had others who were engaged in all sorts of political violence to regain power, particularly, you know, in southern states. So there was this time of both rising levels of equality and rising levels of inequality at the same time, or efforts towards justice and injustice at the same time. And so I think it's an apt description because we're seeing that very same thing now. You have this rising momentum. You have this rising number of Americans, this rising majority of Americans who are serious about truly creating equality and freedom for all. And then you have other Americans who are dead set, you know, against that and are willing to even engage in political violence to stop it.
Do you feel, as a public scholar, given the pushback on scholarship that we've seen, do you feel targeted? I'm not actually trying to be dramatic with this question, right? Like, you know, target on your back. That's not what I mean. But you are so public in your work on anti-racism. And that set of the language, the practices, the discussion that you were so heavily associated with, that we brought forward as a country in those months, in that first year, summer of 2020 forward, do you feel you stand in a hot spot in this moment? And if you do, what is that like for you?
In many ways, it's hard to not open up any of my social media accounts or even my email or other places in which people can reach me and not see all sorts of threats and hate mail and misinformation and disinformation, you know, and attacks. And I think part of it is because one of the most salient and harmful talking points of white supremacists, particularly white supremacist organizations of the last two decades, have now gone mainstream. And so up until recently, a fringe white supremacist idea was this notion that, to quote one directly, anti-racist is code for anti-white. White supremacists for decades have been saying diversity and multiculturalism are anti-white. And then you simultaneously have other, even very prominent media figures are arguing that those of us who are truly fighting for equity for all are actually trying to replace white people. And so if you are white and you believe that people who are striving to challenge racism are in fact trying to harm white people, then you're going to want to imagine that you're defending yourself, you know, against those people. And so, you know, I've been targeted as a result, and many people of all races have been targeted as a result. But I think what many people are realizing is that what's actually the case is those white supremacists are actually not fighting for what's in the best interest of white people. They're engaging in political violence that's undermining a multiracial democracy that benefits us all. They're engaging in policies that prevent us from addressing the climate crisis. And last I checked, white people lived on Earth. Like, they're opposing our efforts to ensure that our libraries are stocked with books for all of our kids. And so that's the irony here.
In that space where you are targeted, right, where there is this aggressive, threatening space, I want to go back now because these are choices to be out front, right? I want to go back to Girl Dad. I want to go back to your words, partner of the real Dr. Kendi. I'm a mom. I'm a spouse. I have kids who, as they come up, were increasingly aware of the choices I was making, right? The place I occupied in the public sphere, knew how to use the Google, right? And see what people were saying, et cetera. How does your family have that conversation now? You're not backing down. How does your family have that conversation now? How do you think about occupying the public space, producing scholarship that educates the public and continues to push those boundaries as you are this person that at its core is a family man first?
Well, the real Dr. Kendi tells me all the time that I'm not doing anything if no one is unhappy. So I think she recognizes this. And in talking to our daughter, I think we, from very early on, were trying to explain to her about the problem of racism, about the fact that there's going to be people who do not like you or who do not like daddy because of the color of his skin. And then there's going to be people who are going to challenge us because we're trying to fight against that notion that we should like or dislike people because of the color of their skin. And so we've tried to be open, you know, with her, because we want her to understand the world that she's living in. And we also want her to, as she gets older, to want to fight for justice and be prepared that there's going to be opposition to that, right? And so that she doesn't become discouraged.
So now let's move to the center. The first time we talked with you here on Radio Boston, you were just coming to Boston. You were just starting the Center for Anti-Racist Research. You've made a really clear set of choices around the importance of data. And here on the show over the last few months, we've had a whole bunch of other conversations with other people and organizations focused on data as well. So I'm thinking of the Health Equity Compact and their push for data at the state level around race and health in some very systematic ways, and systematic data collection, whether it's around COVID or other race factors in health and other categories of data, something that you're focused on. So that's one example. How's it going, basically, on both the push to raise awareness that systematic, codified collection of data that includes a clear-eyed look at race is an important way of understanding everything from health to the environment to socioeconomic outcomes? And have you started now to have enough data to tell us things about ourselves that we didn't know 3 years ago?
So I think we're in the process at the Center for Anti-Racist Research of building and really even launching very soon our racial data tracker. And that tracker will allow, it'll be an online database which will allow users and viewers to see racial disparity data. But one of the things that we have also been doing simultaneously has been really thinking about indeed the critical importance of data collection, but not just racial data collection, the standardization across states, as an example, of racial data, and not just a standardization in which all states are collecting racial data in similar ways, but also really thinking deeply about developing expertise on racial data collection. So we don't want to assume that data scientists have been skilled or taught or trained in how to collect and analyze racial and ethnic data, because that may or may not be the case. And similarly, you can have researchers of racism or race who obviously are not data scientists. So we're really trying to build within our center that expertise on both. You know, for instance, recently, the federal government decided to put out a call for thoughts on potentially revising the way in which the census, particularly the racial and ethnic categories of the census, are utilized and, you know, and collected. So, of course, we put together, you know, a public note, you know, on that. And so we're indeed, like other organizations, you know, trying to build that expertise and also trying to provide resources for people.
We just did a conversation recently on Radio Boston that involved a report from the Boston Indicators Project where they got more granular in some of the tracking on racial data. So, for example, allowing somebody to identify not just as Hispanic or Black, but, for example, Afro-Caribbean.
Yeah.
And getting to that level of, you know, the technical term is often granularity, right? Beginning to allow us to understand who we are as a community better. It was beginning to look at where in Massachusetts our Black community lives. Outside of the city of Boston, moving out into the suburbs, it looked at homeownership and a number of other things. As we ask better questions, as we track data better, how does that feed into better policies that are anti-racist? Connect those dots.
Yeah, so if we, for instance, know that through data collection that Black people in the United States, let's say, are twice as likely to be unemployed as white people, then we can ask the next question, why, right? And if we have an anti-racist perspective, which is to say we do not think that white people or Black people are superior or inferior to another, then the next question is, what are the practices and policies that could be leading to that disparity? And so the actual disparity data really opens the window to the potential racist policies or inequitable policies that are on the books or even practices that allows us to identify those. But more importantly, it allows us to begin to institute anti-racist or equitable policies. However, if we're continuing to track, we can also then see, are those new policies we put in place that are supposed to close that unemployment gap working, right? Because we also can't assume that just because we theorize that a policy is equitable or was equitable in another state, it's going to be equitable in this state. But the other thing is important is the more we get to a granular level, to use your term, the more we can see that, for instance, dark-skinned Black people are more likely to be unemployed than light-skinned Black people. Or we can begin to see that Black gay men are more likely to be unemployed than white gay men. We can see that Black women are more likely to be unemployed than white women. And we can see that immigrants from a particular country is more likely to be. So that then also allows us to ask those questions. Why? What's also happening at a more specific level, which of course allows us to institute greater set of equitable policies.
So in 2021, you stopped collecting data for the COVID racial data tracker. Do you have I don't want to say results from that data, but have you analyzed data to that point that there are key lessons that you want to or can share? Or can you tell us what you're doing with that data in particular now?
So one of the projects that came out of that data collection was indeed really allows us to recognize, as I mentioned earlier, the critical importance of the standardization of racial data collection across states. So we learned through tracking COVID racial data that different states were tracking racial data, were even identifying people in different ways, which then prevented us from having a more national data set or even making comparisons, you know, across states. So that was obviously, you know, one learning. We also realized that because different states were listing the races or ethnic groups differently, certain racial groups were not even necessarily being counted. We also realized, and I think this even speaks to the recent comment we put out on the sort of reconsidering of the census racial categories, that certain groups were almost completely absent, like Middle Eastern Americans and North Africans, and, you know, in the data collection on, you know, on COVID data. So we realized, I think, through that data collection, all the problems, so to speak. And we actually have a, you know, pretty detailed report on our website that lists some of those problems and many of our recommendations.
So a few more questions for you. Since you've been in Boston in these last few years, have you come across any local organizations, local partners that either you think are doing a particularly good job in the data space or asking great questions that are models of what you hope to see more cities, states, communities around the country doing?
We, as a center, I think part of our mandate has been to develop partnerships with organizations in the city and even in the state, you know, in the region who are engaging in similar work, and certainly with scholars as well and other researchers. And the beauty about what's happening is there's so many to choose from. There's so many organizations that are engaging in great work. I feel like I just gave an answer like a politician would.
It was smooth. All right, so let's have a bit of a BU fest for a second, and I'll say that, acknowledging that Boston University holds the license for WBUR as well, but you've got a graphic novel coming out with Joel Christian Gill, who's also a regular here on Radio Boston. It's just cool. So tell us a little bit about it.
I mean, it is cool, and first, it's based on Stamp from the Beginning, this narrative history of anti-Black racist ideas that I wrote. And frankly, Stamp from the Beginning is about 500 pages. I mean, it's a traditional narrative history text. And I know there are going to be many people, of course, who have no problem reading 500 pages, but there may be many more who would rather consume that history in a different type of way. And one of the more engaging ways, I think, to consume information is through graphic novels, through comic books. And fortunately, we have a superstar comic artist at BU, Joel Christian Gill. And so we're partnering and we partnered to produce this graphic novel. And what's also fascinating about this graphic novel is Joel, there's quite a bit of levity, you know, in the narrative, which I think is, you know, is important, because sometimes the history of racist ideas can be so ridiculous, it can only be sort of shared in a comedic form.
So this is the question I wanted to ask you about this. So one of the early conversations we had with Joel, one of the things that he taught me to understand about comics and graphic novels is the space in between the pictures. And that it's in that space in between that the reader begins to tell the story to themselves. There's new interpretation there. Is there anything new you understood about your own work in seeing it put into graphic novel form Did you discover anything in the spaces in between?
Oh, I think there were many things. And I think one of the discoveries for me were connections that Joel made artistically that I didn't necessarily recognize, you know, when I was writing the text, because it's a pretty significant amount of information. And so one of the ways in which the information is portrayed is not just through obviously the conversations, but even through the images themselves or the art. And so, you know, Joel made some very fascinating connections that I think will be very, very helpful for readers to understand this longer story.
So there was the anti-racist baby book in 2020, Goodnight Racism, which is a children's book in 2022, How to Raise an Anti-Racist 2022. You've got Stamp, which is based on Stamp from the beginning, coming out June 6th, which is a lot. In the meantime, you built a center. So what's next? Like, are you going to nap or what comes next?
I probably should nap this summer, but you know, I think I'm just really excited about this graphic novel, but there are some things on the horizon that I'm not able to publicly share.
You're smiling. Yet, you're really smiling.
That I think people are going to be excited about.
That was author and historian Ibram X. Kendi. He joined us last month to talk about his work, about the impact of his project, the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research, and what's next for him.